And our special guest, Richard Smalley, his two books out here, Supernatural, How God Became God. We're going to talk about both of those and take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast and our guest, Richard Smalley. Richard, so back to your work now, How God Became God, with the subtitle, What Scholars Are Really Saying About God in the Bible. What do they believe, anyway?
Well, as I was saying before the break, archaeologists who have studied, you know, the world of Israel and dug up huge amounts of it in that part of the world, generally find that around 850 BC, the archaeological record starts to click with the biblical record. And it starts with King Ahab of Israel in 2 Kings. And there are archaeological remnants of King Ahab's, well, stables, for one thing. There's also a stele, a carved standing stone with an inscription, that which another king says he fought against Ahab of Israel, who came up against him with 2,000 chariots. Well, of course, if Ahab had 2,000 chariots, you would need lots of horses, so of course there would be his stables. So that has been found in Samaria, which was Ahab's capital. After that, things start to click more and more to place. Like about a year ago, there was a news story in which someone had discovered a seal for Hezekiah, who was king of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that makes sense, because Hezekiah ruled around 700 BC. He's from that part of the Bible that's historically clear. Before that, before 850 BC, and that includes not only the flood and creation story, it includes Isaac, Abraham, and Jacob. It includes Moses and the Exodus. It includes David and Solomon, of whom there's no archaeological record. They had this enormous kingdom, supposedly, between Egypt and the Euphrates. Solomon built a palace for his thousand wives. There are no archaeological remnants of this. So you have to assume that much of that was stories created. The Bible started to be written around 760 BC, and it was mostly written by 450 BC, and that's when these accounts were written. Before that, the further you get before that, the vaguer.
What do you think of the stories of the person they call Yahshua, Jesus?
Well, my views about the historical Jesus are in many ways more conservative than that of most scholars. And when I say that, I'm not talking about theology, but I do believe that the basic gospel narrative, that there was a man named Jesus who lived around 30 AD, was baptized by John the Baptist, who is known from other historical sources, started preaching and possibly healing for a number of years. He preached against the religious corruption of his time, and the priests didn't like this, and the priests managed to get him crucified. After that, it does seem that some of his disciples experienced some kind of presence of the risen Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying what that means theologically, but that does seem to be the case. Now, what can I say about this? Well, people do have dead relatives appear to them all the time.
That's right.
I had a friend whose father appeared to him after he died to tell him to make sure to wear a suit to the funeral.
Huh.
Now, was experience of the risen Jesus qualitatively different than these? Well, I don't know. But I'm willing to say, you know, the basic narrative, I think holds together and is the best explanation for all that we have.
Your title says, How God Became God. Explain that for me.
Well, to explain that, you have to start with a notion that God is larger, or spirit, you can use all sorts of names, spirit or reality, sometimes people even use that word, is larger than our minds can conceive. If God is the source of everything, and in fact, my small sons asked me a year or so ago what God was, and I said, well, I couldn't, you know, just thinking at the moment, I said, God is the source of everything. God is where everything comes from. And that's about as good an answer as I've ever come up with. So this God, as God really is really beyond our conception. But we have minds. We have conceptions. We have to have some picture of this. Images, theologies, all sorts of things. Now, this only becomes a problem if you forget that the image is not the reality. If you think the image, your image of God, is the reality, the truth.
Whatever that image may be.
You are basically committing, I would say, an updated version of the sin known as idolatry. In the Bible, idolatry is condemned. People in those days apparently believed that their statues were the actual gods that they were portraying, and that was a mistake, and that's denounced. We're more sophisticated than that these days. In fact, we tend to mistake our images of God for the reality. And what my book is saying is saying a little bit about how this idea of God evolved. Now, it would seem that Yahweh started out first as a national god of Israel alone. This is not particularly unique, because other people mentioned in the Bible, like the Moabites and the Edomites and so on, they all had their own god that they were supposed to worship. The Israelites were supposed to worship Yahweh alone. At first, this didn't necessarily mean that there weren't other gods. It's just that the Israelites were only supposed to worship this one. Later on, around the 6th century B.C., this god, this national god, became identified with the high god. That is to say, shall we say, God in an absolute sense. Now, the Canaanites and the people around them called this high god El, which means God. It's translated God in our translations of the Bible. And Yahweh was kind of the ruling god of Israel alone. But at that point, certain figures, Jewish figures, started to say Yahweh was the same as El, and none of the other gods existed or were worth anything. Now, here's a funny thing. You will look at the Bible, and you'll pick it up, and you'll say, the Lord is God. Well, that sounds incredibly obvious and boring, but what the Hebrew is really saying is Yahweh is El, which was actually a very radical statement in the context of the time. So this national god kind of gradually grew to become identified with the absolute. And it's caused problems, because if your god is the only god in this way, every other people's gods are false, and they're wrong, and you may feel entitled to be somewhat nasty toward them. And that helps explain the history of the last 2,000 years of religious strife.
And it sounds like you believe in the existence of God, but you're like all of us. We don't know exactly what that specifically is, do we?
No, and the idea is, if God is the source of everything, you can only conceive of God in terms of what you know from physical reality. So your concept is going to be limited, and as long as you kind of are aware of that, you're at least not straying too far off course. Here's a funny little illumination of that. What is the last sacrifice that Jesus makes on the cross?
You're asking me?
Well, kind of rhetorically.
Oh, okay, good.
my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Okay.
And I think, you know, one meaning of that is there's a point at which you realize that your image of God is incomplete and wrong, and you have to go on not to disbelief or nihilism, but to a broader, more expansive concept of the divine and its relation to us. And this has to keep going. There's no end of the process, because the infinite is always going to be greater than anything we can conceive of in regard to it.
All right, let's take some calls here for you. They're lining up. Steve in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies. Welcome to the program, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hey, Stephen.
I want to say to your guest that it's really an interesting show, and thank you for being on, and I'll be looking to get your book. I'm really interested in this topic, and I have been for quite a while. I think maybe, time is the big problem. So here we are at almost at the end of the age of Pisces, and we've been through the dark ages. The temple was destroyed along with all the mystery schools and all that knowledge. And so we're grasping at what might have been, history, which has been lost. And there was another big changeover between the age of Taurus and the age of Aries, when the Bible calls it Sodom and Gomorrah. But there's earlier writings that get into a lot of detail about this. And they were really, really old compared to when the Old Testament was written in our Bible. And they tell a story of the flood. And his name was not Noah. It may have been in a different language, but it was Atrahasis. And he was, it wasn't that God caused the flood, but God knew it was coming and said, I don't want to tell the humans because they're really noisy. These creations of mine that, these beings that we made to mine gold have become really noisy, and the blood has been spoiled by it because the DNA has been mixed with the lesser gods and all this other stuff. And the Jewish people were the priestly ones. Abraham's father and his lineage were the priests of Sumer. They were God's chosen people because their bloodline had not been spoiled. That's what I've learned from the readings. I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying this is what I've read. And so my question is, for the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, it was the end of the world for them. And for the people in different ages, at the end of the, everyone didn't die. Even in the Great Flood, everyone didn't die. Mm-hmm. And so if we are in the end times, which I don't think that's what that means, but there's going to be a big change. A lot of people are going to die. That will mean it will have been the end of the age, the end of time for them. Mm-hmm. But not everybody will die. And so isn't it possible that the Old Testament was brought to us from earlier writings?
Yes, and one of the ones you're talking about is the Sumerian epic Gilgamesh, which contains a story of the flood that is older than the one in the Bible. And their equivalent of Noah was called Utnapishtim. And as you were saying, and as I was saying earlier, part of it was simply that humans were getting just too noisy and the gods were getting fed up with them. So these stories do resonate very far back. In that sense, it's true. There are the connections of Abraham with Sumer. That's kind of another matter. One thing that's a problem sometimes people make sometimes is that Abraham came from Ur, U-R. Now, Ur was one of the great capitals of Sumeria. This is like around 3000 BC. Now, the thing is, just Abraham was said to have come from Ur of the Chaldees, which is actually in the northern part of Mesopotamia, unlike the Ur in Sumer, which is in the southern part. Abraham, obviously the Hebrew people had a tradition of some kind of connection with Mesopotamia, the Semites of Mesopotamia. And whether Abraham was a historical character or not, the stories about him are 1,000 years, or written 1,000 years after, at least, after he was supposed to have lived. The Hebrews did seem to retain some kind of memory of a connection.
Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello, Barry.
Hello there, George. I tell you what, how about that crazy rock and roll show I told you last week?
You were right.
Listen, here's my theory on the Great Flood.
All right.
As you know, 30,000 years ago, the big, big majority of humanity was down in Africa. And if you're familiar with the Great African Rift, the rifts are deeper than the Grand Canyon, twice as wide and twice as long. And there's a good chance that those rifts, the two of them, were dammed up and had all the water in them. And George, those dams could have broken and caused a flood that wiped out 90% of humanity, because that's where 90% of humanity lived.
Well, that's very interesting. I don't know a great deal about the Great Rifts myself, but that actually fits fairly closely to what I was saying earlier, that the flood story could well go back to a time when just about the entire human race lived in Africa. So it's possible that particular thing was the cause of it. I can't honestly say one way or another, but what you're saying is actually fairly close to what I was saying earlier.
Richard, as long as you've been doing this, have you come across anything in your work and research that you found to be astounding, startling?
Yeah. And it's in my book, How God Became God. In the Judaism of Christ's time, most people, most of the Jews, many of the Jews, all of the Jews, you could dispute about that, believed in a figure who was called the Great Angel. And this Great Angel was second to God alone. If you were interested in the Kabbalistic tradition, one of his names in the Kabbalistic tradition is Metatron. And here, I'm going to read, this is, again, I'm reading from Philo, a Jewish writer who lived at the time of Christ. He does not know of Christ, but he does talk about this angel, whom he called his firstborn word.
Hold on right there. We'll come back. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Richard Smalley with us, and your calls as well. Richard, we were talking about the astounding things that you would find in your book, and let's talk a little bit more about that.
All right. Well, what I was talking about was a figure whom the Jews of Christ's time believed in, called the Great Angel. Metatron was his name, which is a mysterious origin, but that's one of his names. And I'm going to give you a description, some of the names called that he was called by a philosopher named Philo, who lived around at the time of Christ. He doesn't know anything about Christ, never writes about him, but he does talk about this figure here. And he calls this angel his firstborn word. The eldest, I'm reading verbatim, the eldest of his angels, as the great archangel of many names, for he is called the authority and the name of God and the Word, and man according to God's image, and he who sees Israel. This archangel had many names, as Philo said, and some of these names were the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Logos, the Word. Starting to sound familiar from the New Testament?
Mm-hmm.
This great angel was in the belief of the Christians who wrote the New Testament, incarnated in Jesus. And when they talk about the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Word, that's who they were talking about. This angel was just below God, but according to the Christians, he came down, came to earth, was crucified and died, and was raised to the right hand of God. So he started just below God and was raised to the right hand of God. That is basically the theology of the authors of the New Testament. Not everybody, all of them, put it that way exactly, but that is basically the picture. So they thought Jesus was the incarnation of this great angel. Now, if you read a lot of books on New Testament studies, you will get the wildest and vaguest answers about who the Son of Man was. And a lot of just like, you know, they're like exam questions written by a student who hasn't done any of the reading. The Son of Man does appear in the book of Daniel. What is it? Daniel 3:25 and 7:13, if you want to look that up. And that is kind of the earliest reference to him in the Bible. But they thought Jesus was the incarnation of the Son of Man, the Son of God, not God per se. And that really was not only striking, but it ties together a lot of things that are otherwise very difficult to understand in the New Testament. A second thing that I found of interest, and scholars don't believe this necessarily, because scholars, New Testament scholars, even the most reputable ones, will, you know, tend to exclude things in the Gospels that don't happen to agree with their particular theories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of circular. You have this picture of Jesus, and you carve the New Testament according to this picture, and suddenly this new version of the New Testament, as you've edited it, proves your picture of Jesus. It's circular reasoning, but it is very common. In any case, it does seem that Jesus was widely believed to be descended from King David, that he was considered to be the son of David, and this appears in a lot of sources, and in the Gospels and the epistles of Paul, which were actually written earlier than the Gospels. This is kind of weird. On the one hand, this is in the New Testament. The other thing is like, well, it sounds like Jesus came from fairly humble origins. How could that he was a carpenter or a builder, which is what the word actually means. Could this be, what kind of occupation is this for the illustrious house of David? Well, that answer is very easily found, which is the world is full of aristocratic families who've fallen on hard times. So I believe that whether or not that Jesus was believed, and there were genealogies at his time that went back that far. The ones in the New Testament may or may not reflect these. So Jesus was believed to be the son of David, and at some point, his disciples, the ones who wrote the New Testament, decided that he was the incarnation of the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Word, the Logos. This is actually all fairly simple, but it hasn't been tied together very well, even by the most advanced scholars.
Do you believe he had these mystical powers, Richard, abilities to heal and things like that?
I believe it's certainly possible. I mean, there are holy men, over the years who have shown uncanny powers to heal.
Yes.
John
of God in Brazil, he's one of them.
Yeah, exactly. And there are many more. You know, some of them are famous, some of them are not. I do believe healing is possible. In fact, it occurs fairly often. Even the medical literature has to account for it, but they give it the funny name of spontaneous remission. A person's cancer just vanished that day.
And, yeah.
They don't have any explanation.
No explanation.
It's the naming fallacy.
I would call it a miracle, but they wouldn't.
Right, yeah. And, you know, it's something called the naming fallacy. You give something a name, and that kind of, enables you to pretend that you understand it. But all that said, you know, yeah, these things happen. So I think it's certainly very likely that he did. And where the source of, you know, this healing power comes from, well, there are a lot of things about the human mind that, as I think you'll admit, we just don't know. And there are a lot of human capacities that even ordinary people have that I think we don't know about and haven't developed.
Let's go back to the phones now as we wrap things up. Natalie in New Orleans, you're with us. Hi, Natalie. Go ahead.
Hello. My favorite show on Earth and beyond Earth.
Excellent.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
You too, Nat.
I just basically wanted to say that I don't think there's anything wrong at all whatsoever with people speaking and, you know, questioning and discovering and constantly dissecting. But I do think what's really important is to take it all internally. And the main issue that I have is that the main answer is inside you internally. It's all energy and electricity. And the main reason that we're on Earth is to discover who we are and our name and the higher planes of reality and the higher spiritual existences, and they are real. And healing is extremely real. So is everything that's based on energy and our soul power and our reason for being on Earth, including telepathy, psychic energy, messages, dream travel. But it's all based on the true meaning of being on Earth, which is discovering, celebrating, and love. Love is like the main thing that always comes back over and over and over and over again, no matter how far away you try to get from it. When you go through hardcore tests of time, you get pretty jaded sometimes, but the main highest level of consciousness and the main highest answer to the school of Earth is always love and connectivity and reaching higher levels of consciousness and spirituality. And when you leave Earth, you transcend to higher levels. That's pretty much the main thing that people need to remember.
And it sounds like, Nat, you believe in a higher power, don't you?
What's that?
Natalie, you believe in a higher power?
Yes, definitely. I believe that there's definitely a higher power because I've seen first and foremost in my life through very, very, very hard times that miracles, 100%, huge magic happened right before my eyes, and I even heard messages, and I was told things to do and to take care of things, and I have dreams that happen, and I just believe that anything is possible, and it is based in the human mind with belief, but it's mostly based in the frequency of your soul and your emotions and your heart, which is also connected to your mind, but it's mostly your heart.
Richard, let me ask you this, and Natalie, thank you for your comments.
Mm-hmm.
How do we explain miracles and mystical things? Do we simply say, well, it's God? How do we explain these things?
Well, I'll give you one answer that was given by the Russian philosopher Uspensky, which I think is worth considering. Miracles are when something on a lower level obeys the laws of a higher level. Now, what do I mean by that? Your dream life is in a way like your waking life. There are people, there are things, sometimes they're familiar, sometimes they're not. But, you know, a lot of things are possible in your dreams that aren't possible in physical reality. Like, for example, flying. Many people have had dreams of flying. I have.
Without being in a plane.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So those are laws of our high level. Now, for reasons that are not always clear,
sometimes the lower levels of reality, you know, seem to obey the laws of higher levels that are, shall we say, less rigidly structured. So you do have, you know, cases reported of levitation, people flying in the physical world, you know, as well as in the dream world. So I would say something along those lines. In response to what Natalie said, I agree with a great deal of what you said. The truth in us, of course, this is found all throughout the New Testament, because, of course, it says the kingdom of God is within you. That is a direct quote from the Gospel of Luke. And that within you is called the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. And in the Gospel of John, it's called I am. So in a sense, you could say I am is the way, the truth, and the life. I am is the door. And this is not this I am, this higher self in us, is not, strictly speaking, God. But I think you could say that it is the point in us at which we connect with God.
All right, let us check with Frank in Las Vegas, first-time caller. Good to have you with us, Frank. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would just like to make a quick comment going back to what you were talking about earlier on Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to recall a story back when President Carter was flying back from Turkey. They flew over Mount Ararat, and they saw something on the mountain there. When they saw it, they believed they were looking at a submarine, which was pretty incredible that someone would build a submarine on top of a mountain. But the pilot came over the comm and told them that what they were looking at is what they believed to be the remains of Noah's Ark. And the story did make the Associated Press, but it was very short, and Carter did believe at the time that that was what he was seeing. And I just thought I'd bring that up and take your comments on it.
Okay, go ahead if you want to comment on that, Richard. If not, I shall.
I remember hearing, you know, stories and reports like that. I don't know anything, you know, more about them than you've just said. You know, I haven't myself seen any pictures of them. There could well be something up there, or if it isn't actually Noah's Ark, it could be something up there that gave rise to the idea of Noah's Ark.
Okay, let's go next to Walter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Walt.
Hi, George. Season's greetings to you and your very learned guest.
You too.
Once again, I'm honored to be on the air with you, George.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, George, I was telling Mr. Danheiser, back in the 80s and 90s, I wrote a quasi column for my local newspaper, and I had an essay published, I believe it was back in 1982. And I began the essay with the following words: Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. George, needless to say, those are the famous words that Christ supposedly uttered.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
I believe it was the book of John in the Gospels.
While he was on the cross.
Right. Well, the whole thesis of my essay then, George, was if Christ is asking the Father to forgive his crucifiers for the great sin of crucifying him, well, then how can the sin of crucifixion pay for the sins of mankind in the first place? To me, it just didn't make sense. So the whole thesis of my essay was that this idea of bloodletting and suffering, paying for something, is obviously the result that comes from man's sadomasochistic imagination. The ancients did not understand, they had no inkling of the science of psychology.
Well, as we wrap this up, I have no doubt, Richard, that there's a higher power. Some call it God, call it whatever you want, divine intelligence. There's something as a driving force out there that we don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to respond to what the gentleman said,
I basically agree with you. And to understand why they thought that way, you just have to realize that religious observance in Christ's time was animal sacrifice. The temple of Jerusalem had an elaborate plumbing system just to drain all the blood off. They thought in terms of blood sacrifice. And when, you know, this happened with Christ, whatever the actual experience was, they immediately just thought it had to be a matter of blood sacrifice somehow, because that's, in a sense, all they knew of religion, both the Jews and the pagans.
As we wrap things up, Richard, I want to wish you a glorious new year. Let's hope 2017 is great for you and your family, and thank you for coming on the show again, and I look forward to your next work.
Okay, well, thank you very much. My website is innerchristianity.com, by the way, if people want to follow up on my work.
Okay, and we've got a link for you at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.